Ace of spades.
Ace of spades.
And I guess that's a great way to welcome you all to the Sportscar Safari podcast.
Oh, hang on. Logo off. Hide.
Ooh. Oh, hey. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Another week has gone by. Yeah.
Another day gone.
The bizarre thing, these podcasts, since we've started doing them back at the start of lockdown and coronavirus, and we can kind of chat about this, is that they've really come to just punctuate my week. It's the only thing that's really a constant is just Thursday mornings podcast, and everything kind of fits around that. That's good. It's good.
That's pretty good. Yeah, you don't have kids yet.
No.
Wait till that happens. Anyway.
So, yeah, live on the podcast. I think it's we thought we'd do a cruise show tonight. I hate that term, but we're going to use the term anyway because we are the crew and this is our show. So that kind of makes sense. Because
we call it whatever we wanted, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't like it, start your own podcast. So,
two guys talking about boring stuff about cars.
Hey, it's not boring. It's not boring. But yeah, I think we've actually been doing stuff, both of us, for the you know, this week, and we actually have things to talk about, which for the last 3 months has not been the case. So we do have some interesting guests lined up in the coming weeks, and we've had some interesting guests join us in the past week. So we thought it's a good time to kind of check base and share what we've been up to. So how's it been? Luke, how's Australia
good? Australia's
not
great.
Not Melbourne?
South Australia's great. No, we're doing good. We had a pretty full-on week last week. We took the family up to Mount Gambier and saw, we had to go and see Kingston, go see the Big Lobster.
Kingston Southeast.
Kingston Southeast. Yes, it is. Or SE. Whichever way you want to see it. Go stop and see Larry the Lobster, which is good. What is with the fascination with Australia and big things? Is that in the UK?
Yeah.
Does that happen in the
UK?
No,
not really.
Because you have like actual things like, oh, look at this historic monument from, you know, King Henry II or whatever.
It's
like
the Tower of London. It's like, oh, yeah, that's like dating from the 1200s.
Yeah.
Oh. Sweet.
Check out this fiberglass thing we made in the 60s with asbestos.
There is some. Here's some interesting questions. If anyone in the comments can answer this, when was the last big thing made in Australia? Because Luke, I think you're right. They're all from the 1960s, and there's like the big galah and the big banana, and they all look
and
a little
scary,
bit freaky.
Big ass freaking the koala.
That big koala
with the Melbourne. Red eyes in the night, right?
Oh,
and then it's got the grandpa hairs coming out the ears.
Yeah,
it looks like it's just a big pile of poo.
And they're just all a little bit shit. And there's like a gift shop, and you know, you pay your $3 and you can walk up inside them and get a view of nothing.
And they got a petting zoo.
It's a bit weird.
See, this is what happens when you got kids. You have to stop at all this stuff. That's okay.
I'm not going to when I have kids. I'm just keep driving.
Keep driving.
Sorry.
Go to sleep. I don't know. That'd be an interesting thing. When was the last big thing in Australia made? I guess it's come down to this road tripping thing, right? People seem to fly a lot more and road trip less, and how cheap is a flight to Melbourne from Adelaide? You know, you're not really going along those roads anymore. I guess it was really a sign of that era of, you know, the family wagon holiday,
which in a weird way is coming back because over here, and we can touch on this lately. We'll touch on this in a minute. Our sort of, you know, trip in the shit Boxster, but you can't go to Europe. No one, everyone is holidaying in England here. Obviously, I mean, for those that don't realize, I'm in Cambridge in the UK. Luke is in Adelaide.
Yeah, and I'm the one wearing the jumper.
Mate, I've got blue skies today. It's great. We got to talk about the weather. It's a thing. Yeah, every time
got to do it to annoy Ruth.
Exactly. How's the weather? It's good. Thank you. No, but this is the thing that we've actually tried to, you know, luckily we booked a backup holiday because we kind of knew that our Europe trip was looking a little bit shaky. So we kind of booked a backup trip a couple of weeks ago that we could cancel if we needed to. Mm. And then now we've just gone to add on a few days and change it a little bit. And literally everything in England is booked and or really expensive. You can't, And I've heard the similar things around, you know, we're going down to Cornwall, but there's just no accommodation available. You know, the sorts of hotels that were 70, 80 pounds a night a year ago are now 200 pounds a night. You know, it's, you know, I'm not sure what we're going to encounter. I think we're going to encounter like
all but are your food bills down because the government's paying half of it?
Monday to Wednesday. Get in. It's great. Monday to Wednesday. So yeah, eat out to help out. 50% discount up to £10 per person, not including alcohol. Yeah, it's it's a bit of a bizarre.
Can you imagine the value you could get at a buffet? Oh.
we did all you can eat sushi last week and I felt quite ill after it. And
all you can eat sushi.
Yeah. Got your app, you got 2 hours. Went in too hard too soon though.
Was it like everything else in the UK? Or?
No. The sushi wasn't the best sushi, but it was edible. And you have your app and then you order and they maximum of 6 plates at a time. And I will admit we went in a little too hard too soon. And by about the 45 minute mark, we were done, still with an hour left.
we got across for round one of the SARC state championship, which is pretty cool to go and see. Guys put on a fantastic event down there. It was great. It was good. I mean, just to be back out at it and seeing everyone and lucky enough to help out a little bit. And it was really interesting event in like the way that it was done. It was done, I guess, with COVID in mind and keeping people from being out about too much and stuff like that. So everyone was kind of confined to SEAC Park, which is Southeastern Automotive Club, which is pretty cool. Or Automobile Club? I can't remember.
Fancy. SEAC. Automobile. I think it's Automobile.
Automobile.
That's, I think it's a bit automobile. Fancier.
They've got a track just out of Mount Gambier, which is pretty cool. It's very cool little track.
Like, I was gonna say, I watched obviously the hat you're wearing is IAS rally team Guy Tyler and Mike Dale, who I think won the event, but watching their in-car that they shared on Facebook, mate, that track looks so good. Just
like elevation and tunnel cool. Anyway, so they kind of made that base service park, which was good. Had a Saturday night round, which was good. Very, very minimal lighting. So it was pretty dark. We I was helping GT and Mike out with that. So we had Ray who's Independent Air Solutions, who was helping out and doing a lot of work, and Busby was there too helping out, which was great. And so we were like fitting lamp pods on Friday night, getting ready for Saturday and stuff like that, which was good, wiring all that up. But yeah, so very dark Saturday night round, which was cool. So much mud, like mud, which is cool.
That's good fun. As long as you're not the one that has to clean it up, good fun.
so we thought that no one was going to be able to work on the cars or do anything with it, you know, just normal rally rules and servicing and everything. And and then I'd left because I had we had go home and get the kids and all that kind of stuff because they came with us. And Buzz and Ray stayed behind for a bit longer and figured out that they could actually wash the car. So they had the job of scraping the mud out, which was copious amounts. Huge amounts.
To be fair, though, I gotta say, it's a little bit cathartic, though. You just kind of, I am no mechanic, but I like jobs working on cars that you get like a lot of progress and you don't really need to think about it. It's very easy, but lots of progress. And I think scraping mud off a car, it's good. Like you can
just scraping mud.
Yeah,
it's great. And then on the Sunday, it was 3/4 of a day, I guess. Stages were from SEAC Park out to the forest, do some stages in the forest, come back to SEAC Park again, then service, and then go out again and repeat that a few times. So it was pretty cool the way they kind of, because usually with rallies, service is you know, is dead quiet and non-existent for the entire event until, you know, there's critical times at lunch and things like that, and where people come back and then bang,
and then dead.
But it was really cool because everyone was kind of rare. I was going out, the first cars were starting to come back in, which was really cool. So, it was a really cool event. It was great. And locals were good fun. Buzz and I had to go to Super Cheap, which is around the corner from where we were staying, to pick up some electrical parts, and pulled up just as we're going in, just hear this whoop, 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 and this is like AU Falcon doing like a drift round a roundabout.
I was going to say, if there's one thing that Mount Gambier is known for, it's AU Falcons.
Any four-litre Falcon, it was unbelievable. One of the guys who was two doors around the corner from where GT and Busby and Ray and Mike and stuff were staying, he was like he had an auto electrician business, and so we had to go around there to get some parts, and I had to drive his car down there because he was too drunk, so I had to get in his car for a night, drive him down there because he had too many beers, and get in his shop, and he's got a BF Falcon street stocker, so like the stock dirt circuit car and stuff.
You twist his arm and be like, come on, lap around the block?
Let's do it. It was on a hoist, otherwise I probably would have. It was pretty funny. That was pretty cool to go to I guess get back into motorsport again and I guess help out GT and Mike and Ray and help them get across the line, which is pretty cool. It was pretty close fighting at the start until Zane lost quite a fair bit of time in the forest after hitting a tree. It was quite slick out there, according to everyone. It was pretty clay and slippery and first event out, which was pretty cool. But yeah, that was great.
So funny you say the first event, because on the weekend I went out to cover an event at Brands Hatch. It was just a sort of a local club racing series, which was pretty cool. I realized I hadn't been to a live motorsport event since I think Goodwood Revival in like October last year. Like, we're getting on for nearly 12 months, and I hadn't really shot like a live event for, you know, 6-7 months. And the first couple of hours, I didn't know what was going on. Like, I got there and I it was really wet and it was raining, and I got there and I was like, I was wearing the wrong shoes. I didn't bring an umbrella. I didn't bring the clip for my monopod, like all of this really basic stuff. And then I was like, what's going on? And then I sort of realized that I hadn't actually left the house in any sort of professional capacity for a good 6 months. And it was just like, oh yeah, putting shoes on, you know, and an umbrella, like these basic things that we kind of haven't had to deal with for 6 months. And it took me a good 3 or 4 hours to get back into the swing of panning a car and, you know, holding a camera and like all this really basic stuff.
I haven't shot events for ages, and like moving motorsport events. And of course, Saturday night comes. What is it? Night event. No lights anywhere.
Challenging shooting you could ever have.
Let's shoot it at a tenth of a second and see if I can make something come out.
It's art.
Yes, it is art.
But no, it's good. It's good to be. It's good to be back.
You were out shooting for
BMW Car Club, GB. We were covering their racing championship, which they have. It's pretty cool. It's part of what's called the 750 Motor Club, and it's an organization that sort of started in the late 1930s, and the 750 comes from the engine capacity of a Austin 7, 750cc's, and it was kind of Austin 7 racing in the 30s and kind of immediately post-war. It's kind of spawned into a sort of a really, I wouldn't say budget, no, I probably would say budget, but it's like a kind of a collective of entry-level race series. And they organize these events where they have these different championships. And one of them was the BMW Car Club Racing Championship. They had a one-make series for Renault Clio Sports, like the early sort of first generation Clio Sports. They had another category for EP3 Civic Type Rs. They had one for, you know, the home-built clubman type vehicles, and sort of all of these, just real kind of grassroots racing. But it looked like this Renault Clio Championship, the racing was so close, and it might as well have been BTCC. Like, it's really cool.
That,
and they
don't have Excel Cup over there. It's kind of like Excel Cup.
Yeah, it's basically Excel Cup. To be fair, it wasn't quite as close, and the racing wasn't as good. I think Excel Cup is pretty unique in how competitive it is. But it was it was kind of more like HQ Holden's, probably, that the HQs back in the day. This was sort of like that.
Right.
But yeah, it was just real good grassroots racing, you know, no pretension, no million-pound cars, you know, nothing, none of this, just proper door-to-door close amateur racing, which was
some of the BMW club cars look like they had a fair bit of money spent on them, though.
Yeah, E46 M3s with heroin. Yeah, and to be fair, the BMW cars were probably the sort of the upper edge of there, like they were probably the fastest, you know, most costly. But to be fair, that was that they had what, four classes of racing, and the of the first two or three classes where you're so highly tuned M3s and, you know, running big stroker S50s and all that sort of stuff with aero. But the lowdown categories, there was, you know, they have a class for the E46 touring, the E46 compacts. They have one make kind of for the 1.6 and for the 1 series as well. So, I mean, you can pick them up for £1,000, £1,500 over here. And they've got a control package that you buy for a couple of grand, and it's got, you know, the suspension and a roll cage, which you weld in, and brake pads and wheels and tires, and go racing, you know. So it is pretty accessible. Pretty accessible way to get onto the track. Does
the Porsche Club have a Boxster class?
They do, actually. Yeah. But no, actually, that is not accessible racing.
Do you know, when you bought the Boxster, and I think earlier on we were talking about the old PlayStation 1 Porsche Challenge game or whatever. I think we both had it as like a demo. It came with like a PlayStation.
Then, so it's a bit hard to, you know. But yeah,
I downloaded the ROM for that the other day, so I've got to have a crack at that when I get a second and relive horrible graphics and driving physics in PlayStation games. So
amazing. So yeah, well, speaking of Boxster, and I guess it's the we haven't done an update on the ship Boxster for a while, but I guess we can give a quick update now. It's all running really well, and the reason why there hasn't I know it is from a story point of view, it's really boring. The reason why I haven't really done an update for a while on our Instagram page is just because there's not really anything to share. Like, it's I've done 1,000 miles in it now, and it's all running well. Like,
maybe that could boring. Be like what we could do, which would actually be really funny, is like every day is an Instagram story if you're just going out, starting the Boxster, going, yep, still starts, turn it still off starts. And look, see how long we can keep that going for.
Don't get me wrong, there are definitely some noises that make me nervous, and I'm planning another round of work on it in a couple of weeks' time. Now that I was a bit hesitant to invest too much money into it until I knew that it was going to be a pretty solid thing that I want to keep. And I think 1,000 miles now, it's proven itself, so I'm happy to go and sort of fix some other things on it. So there will be some more work coming on it, and there are still some noises that I just sort of go, oh, I'm going to choose to think that that's nothing bad. But you know, after 1,000 miles, I haven't got any worse. yeah, I'm gonna go with that's normal and carry on.
Those rusty brake discs can stay rusty for a long time.
actually, there was this noise. It was, I think I said in the stories, it was making this kind of rotational turn the wheel, and it gradually kind of went away to a point where it had kind of gone.
Yeah.
And then our friend George Cheatham, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, we were out for a bit of a scoot the other week, and I was leading him through this beautiful corner not too far from my house. It's just a beautiful sort of downhill flowing left-hand bend. I was punting the car harder than I've punted it before, and we hit this corner, I reckon about 85 mile an hour, allegedly, and into this bend, fourth gear up in the rev range, and it was just loading up nicely and just like, just grip it. And I was like, this is great. Like, yeah. And then as soon as I straighten the car up, whoa, that noise was back really loud. And I was like, oh man.
So what is it then?
I don't know. It's kind of gone away again. So I've gone with, it's nothing serious. So yeah, we'll see. Keep you posted. But we were gonna be, we had, I guess I was kind of keeping this on the down low It was going to be a very amazing story and a very cool thing. I managed to string together a pretty exciting debut trip for it. We'd arranged a, just through some other writing I do, some travel writing, I'd actually arranged a hotel stay at Villa d'Este on Lake Como for this weekend, actually. And we were going to drive it to Villa d'Este through the Swiss Alps, top down. And then the irony being that I got the sort of the information through for the room, and I realized that the room for two nights, the cost of our stay was going to be more than I paid for the Boxster in the first place. So I thought that was quite ironic, and valet parking it at the front, and it's the place where they have the Villa d'Este Concours, and I was going to be that guy, and I was like,
George Clooney down the road.
And I was like, here's old mate Aussie Bogan turns up in his shitty dented $2,000 Boxster, like, this is going to be fantastic. And
not knowing what clothes to wear because he hasn't been on holiday for ages.
Yeah, exactly. Don't work an iron anymore. But so we had the Eurostar booked and it was going to be this amazing trip. But then, of course, they've recently changed the quarantine rules and the virus kind of seems to be taking off again in Europe. So we kind of made the decision that it probably is not such a wise idea to go. So we've unfortunately cancelled that trip, and we're going to be leaving tonight, which was kind of a bit of a downer. We're supposed to be in about 2 or 3 hours time heading down to the Eurotunnel and onto Europe in it. But instead we're going to Cornwall next week. So we're still going to do 1,000 miles or so around Cornwall in it. So no, it's not. It's the English seaside with the rest of England. but don't worry, there's still ample opportunity for the thing to break down and leave us stranded. So it might still turn into,
because it has been pretty warm up there too. So
yeah, it's been good. It's been stormy the last, but in terms of the Boxster, actually, I had to take it into London a week or so ago, and it was 34, 35 degrees, which is actually, to be fair, that's actually very hot for the UK. Mm-hmm. And I had to get through about half an hour of sort of stop-start London traffic to kind of get through where I wanted to. And, of course, one of the things that doesn't work is the air conditioning. And when I got the car, I was like, yeah, it's England. You don't need air conditioning. It's fine. And then when it's 35 degrees, and you're in city traffic with leather seats and a hard top, I was sweating bullets going, okay, I really need that air conditioner now. But importantly, the thing, temper gauge didn't budge. It kind of came on. I could hear the various thermo fans doing their things and running. And it's really good. Like, it's,
to be honest with how long that car's been sitting, it's probably just got low aircon gas or something like that.
Yeah. Probably not much. It's one of the things we'll sort in the coming weeks, so that's the Boxster. Otherwise, it's actually just like I kind of got this thinking we're embarking on this kind of crazy adventure of how stupid is this, and we're going to have all these problems, and it's going to end up being parted out in a tow truck, and it's just going to be a great story to tell down at the pub. But actually, it's turned into a really boring story to tell down at the pub. Like, bought a cheap car and it was good.
That's because you didn't buy a 166.
Well, yeah, it's not Italian. That's probably where you went wrong.
Speaking of, well, that was an exciting development this week. I finally, after weeks and weeks and weeks, got the gearbox from Tasmania, which is
for your Apple 166, which has a dodgy automatic transmission.
Yeah, it's like some ZF thing that's sealed that you're supposed to never touch the oil on because it's good for life, apparently. Apparently, oil doesn't break down in a gearbox when you say it's sealed for life. It's like,
but you see, the question is it is sealed for life and it is good for the life of the gearbox. It just depends on kind of how long the life is. And if you're Alfa Romeo, you would probably say the life is like 8 years or just
no
2 months. 2 months after warranty.
100% what it is.
You're out of life.
They have the same gearbox on like Citroens and other bits and pieces, and like all those. Huh? That's great for a lot of people. Yeah,
no, it's really good. It's on Citroens too. Like, yeah.
Actually, it's the same one as Standen's C5. It's the same as the same V6. And that gearbox worked great through Tassie. And this gearbox is coming from Tassie too. So all the Citroen stuff have dipsticks and things where you can check the oil, whereas the 166 version has like a drain plug and a fill plug, but no way to check the oil level. Really? Yeah. The way you're supposed to check the oil level on it is using the OBD sensor and the software. Get the gearbox to a certain temperature, open the plug, watch and make it like, it's so funny, the Italian workshop manuals, right? Watch for certain, like, it's like, watch for flow. And it's like, what kind of flow? Like, is it supposed to be flowing out, completely flowing out? And it's like, you know, if there's not enough flow, put some in there. And it's like, And then while it's open and like there might be oil flowing out, you have to get the gearbox temperature up to temperature and then fill it up again.
Like, how do you get an automatic transmission up to temperature in the workshop?
Oh, it just sits there and gets warm.
Oh, okay.
Just yeah, because I mean, you got to think like. Stuff so
You know, it's not just Italians in you know, I remember when I
got the same gearbox in BMW as well and things like that,
so. Yeah, no, but like to be fair, it's more of a modern car thing, just being stupid. I remember back in my service advisor days in the industry, you know, Volvos were classic in that they had an engine that was designed to have a dipstick, yet they'd retrofitted a digital oil level sensor. And the only way to check the oil level was, as you say, to plug it into the computer. And then the oil level was expressed as a percentage of full. but what it meant was that you couldn't really check, like it wasn't a quick job to just check the oil level. Mm-hmm. So someone would come into us and be like, hey, can you just top the oil up? You know, I've got a low oil or something like that. And you'd say,
600 bucks?
I need to book the car and it's going to take like 45 minutes. And they're like, what? And I say, yeah, well, by the time you bring it into the workshop, you clear a hoist space, you put it on the hoist, you plug it in, you run it through its diagnostic cycle, get the engine to the correct operating temperature, it expresses the oil, you fill the oil to the level, you clear the codes. Like, yeah, it's a 45 minute process just to check the oil level and brim the oil. And the annoying thing was these engines actually had the blanking plug over where a dipstick would go. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have one. And you're like,
this is the same, same as the 166 gearbox. So the 166 gearbox has basically the spot which the Citroens has for a dipstick, but no dipstick in there. You know, it's crazy.
Anyway,
makes sense. But hence,
so you've got a gearbox on the way.
I found a gearbox in Tassie from a guy, super lovely guy, and was very patient. And like the whole courier debacle with COVID at the moment was just horrendous. Wow. Like I found a company and I was like, they were going to book it and it was going to go through another company. And I was like, yeah, no worries. I booked it, paid the money, waited a week. And then they came back with, oh, can you send us pictures of the packaging? And I was like, that's a bit weird. Okay, no worries.
Sure.
Send them the pictures. And of course, the other thing that I was trying to skirt around as well was that they said that gearboxes and engines and stuff must be drained of all fluids. I didn't want to drain the fluid out of the gearbox because the gearbox has never been opened and then it would scrub the oil level again and then you're back to square one. You know, it's kind of like, it's like, fellow, like, who's on first, what's on second? Well, third base, you're screwed again. Trying to like, you know, skirt that and, you know, make sure the guy had packed it properly and all this kind of stuff. So I sent them the pictures and then I get a thing back, oh, sorry, we can't book that because it's not an original manufacturer casing or whatever. Not
this is Tasmania.
And I'm like, wow. Okay. So this was like a third party courier company. You just kind of, they just farmed it out to whoever. They just kind of contracted whoever to do it. So then I ended up going direct with a company and that was great. And that was good. The company who they were going to book it with, I just booked it direct with them, of course. And then, and they were okay. But the problem with them is that they were like, they wouldn't let the guy drop it off at a depot. But it was going to be an extra $200 to pick it up from a residential address as opposed to a business address. And so I got it delivered to work here in Adelaide because it was going to be another $200. So it's going to be like, basically, you know, two-thirds more than what the shipping cost actually is just because it's a residential address. And so, like, book it in. The guy said, "Oh, yeah, I'll be home, you know, this time and day, and I'll book in. I'll be home working from home. We'll be good. The courier can come past anytime during the day. So book it all in. This is like a week in advance. So he had, you know, booked in, all good to go. Courier didn't rock up in Tassie. So then, you know, chase back the other guys, and so the courier company I use, they've subcontracting Tassie because they don't have an office. And so they couldn't get a hold of the courier company. no phone calls, no replies to email for like 4 days. And then I get an email from the guy in Tassie, oh yeah, courier came past at like 5:30 tonight. Like, good thing the wife was home and they picked it up and off it went. And then it was here in a couple of days. But it was just like
madness.
It was like almost 4 weeks of mucking around with couriers to try and get a gearbox from Tassie to Adelaide.
Tasmania is such an odd place in that it is an absolutely beautiful state.
Yeah.
And the cities are very modern and metropolitan and cosmopolitan and great and fantastic. But the second you get out of them, you really are in the country. Like, there's no gradual, like, you're proper country. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. But I mean, this guy was pretty close to Hobart. He wasn't far out of Hobart. And he goes,
Hobart's a wonderful city.
Yeah, oh,
Hobart's a great city.
So
I'd live there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. And so anyway, the email I got from him, speaking of like Tassie things, because I was like, you know, he said, oh, the driver just rocked up, and I was like, wow, I said, did they call you or just rocked up? And he goes, nah, just rocked up. Yeah, it seems to be the way in Tasmania. They just do whatever they want to do.
I kind of want to do that. I want to go there now. That sounds great.
Dad, do you want to do that job? Nah, you know what?
Nah.
In another 4 days, I'll rock up.
Nah.
But, yeah, so that's sitting in the office. I'm probably going to pop past tomorrow, pick up, and then probably start ripping apart.
There you go.
To fix that, which is fun.
That sounds like fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a lot more fun than a reliable Boxster.
until, and I'm very conscious of this, until the Boxster is not a reliable Boxster, which is coming. Like, it is coming. There is something coming. I don't know what and I don't know when, but there is something coming.
Hopefully not. But, yeah, they're more than likely will be. It's getting to that age now where it's just starting to go.
You know, it's funny listening to this the recent sort of Smoking Tire podcast. I'm really excited now just to put like 200,000, put an extra 100,000 miles on it or something, get it up to 200, just put a million miles. Because, you know, it's such a good quality car. Like, it's not junk.
And how many is done, you know, 200 and something?
It's done 122 miles, so about 200,000 Ks. But the thing is, like, is tight. Yeah. It's rattle free. There's not a single rattle anywhere in the car. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, if I actually maintain it properly and change the oils and follow like a rigorous service schedule and fix problems as they occur, like, there's no reason that thing won't do 300,000 Ks, 400,000 Ks.
Yeah. You could just buy a VX Commodore and just never service and never touch it, and it will still last 400,000 Ks.
Actually, in England, a VX Commodore here would actually be quite humorous, actually.
But if you get like a VX wagon or something like that, like,
while we're talking about really, really interesting things, just odd things you see in the UK, car-wise, sometimes you see some things here that just make no sense whatsoever. And I think yesterday I saw the thing that has made the least sense to me. It actually makes sense, but also
still made out of wood. Is that like,
they still make them organs? Yeah. No. So not too far from us in Cambridge, there, I think there's an Air Force base, and I think they have a fair few. There must be like an American base here. They have a fair few, you know, US personnel.
Yeah.
So in Cambridge and around the area, I think they can bring their cars with them. Some of them do. And you see the most bizarre American cars over here. So like in the car park a few weeks ago, I saw a brand new Lincoln Navigator, like big black left-hand drive Lincoln Navigator on like some sort of a Kentucky plates or something really weird like that. And I was like, okay, that's odd. But then it got even weirder. I was at the service station a week or two ago, and I saw an E92 330 CI coupe. So not the turbo one, just the straight six standard E92 coupe. Left-hand drive on Nebraska plates.
Why would you?
Like, I mean, if you were actually paying shipping, I think the shipping, that's like a 2,000 pound car here, a 1,500 pound car. And I think they must have been some sort of military personnel, and they probably could have had the option to bring their car with them when they came over to the UK, and they just did. And it was probably flown over in a, you know, US government Hercules or whatever, some sort of transport plane. No, but literally it was a proper on Nebraska plates. And so it got weirder. I thought that was the weirdest thing I'd see. And then yesterday, it actually caused me to miss my freeway exit. I had to drive I was driving and I got so distracted by this truck that I completely missed my freeway exit and I had to drive another 25 minutes up to the next junction and then back. Driving. And, you know, different countries, they just have different styles of trucks. So Australia has the kind of the Kenworth Mack style.
Oh, you mean you know, truck, with the truck?
Truck, like, truck, like prime mover.
Like pickup truck, like you truck.
No. Prime mover. Prime mover.
Yeah.
And so Australia has like the Kenworth Mack style, you know, that Aussie style. Europe has the sort of the Volvo Scania European style of kind of very front forward sort of trucks. And I was driving and I saw a prime mover towing a trailer and it had something on the trailer. I don't know what it was, but it was nothing big. And it was one of those American Freightliners. You know how they have the Freightliners with the dually rear wheels and kind of a very American truck. And it wasn't in army colors. It was in blue and it had American plates. I didn't quite catch the state, but it was a really bizarre sort of backwards American state in the middle of nowhere. And someone had brought over a left-hand drive prime mover and they were just driving down the freeway towing something on the back of this truck. And I was like, why, how, who? But it wasn't even in camo. It was a completely civilian prime mover, left-hand drive on American plates.
Sure, was an Optimus Prime or something like that?
Maybe. and I missed my junction. I was looking in the mirror. I pulled in front of him and I was looking in the mirror trying to figure out what state the plates were from. And then, anyway, so yeah, true story.
Why would you? I still don't get the BMW one is confusing. He mustn't have paid for shipping then. Mustn't have paid for shipping.
I think there's an option. I think they can do it. And look, my guess with this truck is maybe it was some sort of military contractor or something that maybe had a contract to supply the US Army with some sort of logistics over here. And they, for some reason, brought their own trucks rather than hiring them here. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, still very, very odd. So yeah, anyway.
That's hilarious.
Great podcast. I saw a truck.
Well, you did. You have been, and I haven't read your post yet, purely because I wanted to ask you about it and discuss about it with you because I, you know, obviously being stuck here with not much happening at the moment is a bit disappointing. But you drove.
I did a Testarossa.
One, you know, maybe your one has less stance. This poor model
wasn't stanced.
Check out the
oh yeah, it's got the premium large sized Scuderia shields on the guards there. I like that. That's very good, the extra stance.
It's lost a fair bit of it's been squashed a few times.
Look, I did.
It wasn't like a proper belt, but you had a drive, yeah? What did you do?
So this car has been in storage for a few years. I do some work with a company called Quest Brothers Classic Cars. It's in their storage facility, and we're going through the process of getting it out, using it, but you know, cars like this, you can't just turn the key after, you know, the Boxster, you kind of got away with it. Testarossas and stuff, you can't just sort of turn the key and drive them after they've been kind of laid up. So we're going through the process of getting it kind of, you know, recommissioned and ready for the road. So the first step was a week or so ago, kind of start it, run it up to temperature, check all the fluids, make sure that it, you know, it's all good, you know, give it a check over.
There's not fuel flying out everywhere.
Flying out of it, you know. And the thing with these is you just can't rush. Like you can't be in a rush because as soon as you're in a rush to drive it, you miss stuff and that's when damage occurs. So we spent, you know, a couple of hours and did that. Yesterday was the kind of take it for a shortish drive, a slow drive, get it through an MOT inspection to get it, you know, all approved. And that's what we did yesterday. So yeah, did about 6 miles, isn't it? Yeah, it's good, few little issues to fix. And then, you know, once we've done that, we'll get it out and take it on a longer drive and a faster drive. And I'm sure that's when the you know, the real joy will kind of come. But no, very cool thing. Like it's just even at, you know, I don't think we got out of third gear, like, but to be fair, it's a very long geared car. So third gear is still reasonably quick.
Because it's still like, yeah, it's still like cool GT style cruising gearing for them.
Yeah, like 20 mile an hour around like schools is first gear. Like you're in first gear at sort of those sort of speeds. But yeah, no, just like a horribly flawed car. In objective terms, it is a terrible thing. And there is just so much that's just ridiculous about it. But then you listen to the noise it makes and you just look at the thing and you look at the reaction on kids' faces and it's just the coolest car in the world. Like it is the coolest car in the world. And it's I guess, you know, we can sort of going through ergonomically, as you would expect.
How did you go being a short fella?
Atrocious. Absolutely short atrocious.
The short Italian frame that you have.
I don't even think a short Italian person would fit anything. I mean, I'm tall. I'm what, 6'2"? I'm tall, but I'm not abnormally tall. I'm not 7 foot or something like that. I'm just a regular tall person.
Well, and you're not 6'2" and 150 kilos either.
Kilos. So. No, I'm, you know, quite slim. Couldn't fit in the car with my hat on. I had a cap on, had to take the hat off because the cap was squashed against the roof and kind of pushing down. So with the hat off and my head kind of brushing against the top of the roof, you can then adjust the seat that you can either be correctly placed for the pedals or for the steering wheel. You take a pick. You can't be correctly placed for both at the same time.
That's all Italian cars of that era though, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah.
You know, growing up driving Sudden 33s and stuff like that, it's always arms right, legs up around your ears somewhere.
Yeah. And to be fair, it wasn't that bad, but it was still, I got myself good for the pedals and the steering wheel was a bit far away and it was kind of tilted sort of back at a bit of an odd angle. So, but when you're driving at speed, it actually was pretty good. It was just when you're sort of maneuvering around town, it was just all just weird. The buttons, the switch gear makes no sense. It's really weird. The lights.
You don't need them.
No. But the thing that was weird about it was how good some of it was and how absolutely shit the rest of it was. The light switches, the stalks, the indicator stalks were actually really good. Like they felt good. They turned, felt nice. Yet all of the other switch gear was 1980s Fiat and absolute junk.
Are the indicator stalks thin metal ones or are they like thick?
Thin metal with a bit of plastic on.
Yeah, perfect. So, even for that era of car, like they'd already started going over to big, clunky, plastic, horrible feeling things. So that'd be a nice change in a car of that era to have.
But it's really weird
type stuff.
It's almost as if they started building bespoke switch gear for this car and then got like a third of the way and then gave up and then just got Fiat parts bin stuff for the rest. Like the electric window switches are just junk, like absolute junk.
Right.
Yet the light switches are beautiful.
They start doing it and then like Enzo's walked through and said, "What do you mean you haven't finished the car yet? Hurry up." And then it's
like,
just,
do you know how expensive this is? This stuff is free. Like, you know, I mean, the ventilation was a nightmare. I couldn't work out how to get air on the windscreen. For some bizarre reason, the odometer is in the lower part of the console down near the gear shifter. Who knows why? It was cool. And then you kind of drive this and it's so low and it's so wide that, you know, and the thing you do forget when you're driving it, you do forget this and you need to bear in mind the fact that it is so much wider at the back than it is the front. So just because you've placed, it wasn't close, but like there was a time when I was going down the road and there was a bus coming the other way and there were some parked cars. So he kind of pulled onto my side of the road a little bit.
And this was left-hand drive too, yeah?
Left-hand drive, yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of squeeze past him, which in the UK is, you know, par for the course. It kind of happens all the time. And I sort of judged it and went, yeah, there's a ton of space. I'll be fine. And then looked in the mirror as the bus went past and was like, oh, actually, that was a little bit tighter than I kind of thought it was. And then I just forgot that, the back of the car is a good foot wider than the front of the car is. So you've always got to kind of remember that when you're placing it on the road. But you know, all of this goes completely out the window when you hear it. As soon as the engine starts and the noise, it is just ridiculous. I mean, this one had a tubey exhaust on it, so it was, you know, no cats or anything like that. So it was proper good. And I mean, I got up to sort of, you know, 4,000-6,000 in a cup, you know, in the lower gears and it was good. But I mean, I think that thing at 80, 90, 100 mile an hour on the motorway at the top of third would just be glorious. Absolutely glorious.
Cool.
But it's, I was just gonna say, it's one of those things, you know, we've been sort of talking about Porsches a lot, and we've had a lot of Porsche people on the podcast, and I've been spending time in a few Porsches, and I've kind of going, you know, I really love the fact that they're just so well built, and the breadth of ability is so wide, and you can daily drive them, you can race them, you can do all these things. But you drive a Testarossa and you realize that they just don't have the emotion that the Ferraris do. Like, it's the emotion. I mean, the Porsches are always nice, but they never really get your heart properly racing. They're just, you know, they're this solid car that's, you know, but then you drive the Testarossa and it actually makes your heart skip a beat, and you actually feel like, I mean, I went to get petrol in the thing, and I literally felt like I was 12, and you know, you look at those cars when you're 12 and you dream of like driving them. And I felt like a 12-year-old kid that had somehow been allowed to drive this Testarossa, and I was walking towards it. My heart, I was like, this is awesome. I was like, this is so cool. And I think, you know, Italian supercars, just, they do that to you, where I think a lot of the German stuff, as much as I love them, and I still doesn't, I don't love them any less, but they just don't give you that kind of pulse. So yeah, very cool. Very cool experience. Very cool.
Yeah, I can imagine. It would have been amazing.
Yeah. So hopefully in a few weeks we'll do it again and go a bit further and a bit
faster. Got through Mont, got registered and stuff, all right?
Yeah, it's all through Mont. So awesome. Yeah, we'll got a few little things to fix. Fuel gauge doesn't work, but you don't need that.
It's the important bit. If it doesn't work, if the light comes on, you're good.
I took it and put 25 liters in it because I was like, at least I know it's got something in it. Because, you know, we're having this, I was sort of having this thought. I was a bit too scared to venture too far from the storage facility, because I was like, if you break down in the thing, I genuinely don't know how you would get it towed back, because it physically doesn't fit on most of the tow trucks that the AA and sort of the breakdown services have. It's too low and it's too wide. It just doesn't fit. So I kind of had this thought tempered with, you know, I want to go and drive this thing and I want to take it. But also I was like, if this thing breaks down, it's not proven yet. If it does break down, I literally am screwed. Like, I actually don't know how you'd get it back. You'd have to find someone with a specialist, you know, race car transporter or something.
You need to call Roddy up. Get Roddy up.
Yeah,
there.
Get Roddy up. But hey, it's not a... Jordan, mate, I'm stuck, you know. But it's not a simple... And I guess, you know, I'm going to try not to go on a rant here, but it's like, I think myself included, a lot of people a lot of people are like, yeah, I daily drive this car, you know, and you look at, you see these people with these Ferraris and these Lamborghinis and these great cars that don't drive them very often. And you know, I've been like, if that was in my shed, I would drive it all the time and I'd put 10,000 kilometers on it every year and I'd do this and I'd do that and blah, blah, blah. But then you actually live with these cars and you realize why people don't drive them very often, because they have such a narrow breadth of ability and there are so few times when you can actually use a car like this. Like, you can't take it shopping because it doesn't fit in most of the parking spaces here and someone would open a door on it and it probably wouldn't get in the driveway with speed bumps. Like, it just, you couldn't do it. You know, you can't really, you know, small lanes, it doesn't fit. You know, the breakdown risk, it's like, if I break down, it's going to literally ruin my day because I don't know how to get it home. So you'd need to be ringing around to find a specialist who can come out and recover it, you know. And then, you know, you look at the insurance, this one's a little bit leggy, so it's not such an issue, but especially when you start talking mileage and you start, you know, literally every 1,000 miles drops the value by whatever, which maybe that's important to you, maybe it's not, but you know, for some people that's a concern. You know, you've got all of these factors, and you know, you don't want to take it out when the weather's terrible, you don't want to take it out when it's too hot because the air conditioning doesn't work, you don't want to take it out when it's too cold because the heater doesn't really work. And it's like, when you actually put all of this into the churn, there really is like several like half hour windows when those cars make perfect sense, but the rest of the time you don't want anything to do with them. Like, you know, you just don't, they don't work in most circumstances. So yeah, like, I mean, I don't understand people who that have 10 of them and just never drive them. I think that's wrong. But yeah, like, people that have one in the shed and they take it out like once or twice a month and do half an hour in it and put it away, I totally get that. Yeah. I can see how that happens. Yeah, you know, yeah. I like to think that I'd be different if I had one, but I probably wouldn't be. I'd probably be just the same, you know.
Yeah. It's hard to say until you actually have the thing. But yeah, I definitely agree with like day-to-day living with it and just the effort that goes into that. And also as well, like even cars of that era as a whole, generally, even Porsches and everything like that too, like compared to more modern cars, 100% so much more effort to try and daily drive them.
Yeah. Not to mention, I mean, in Testarossa, it's engine out for belts every, you know, X number of miles. The other thing as well is that it gets lots of reactions, even on a short drive, and not all of them positive. Oh, especially, really?
Not negative. You didn't have any, like, yelling at it or anything?
No. Nothing outwardly negative. I think 50% of the reactions were very positive and people going like cool and people appreciating it for what it was. But I think especially now, maybe in a pandemic at the time, you know, a lot of people are hurting, especially over here, unemployment. It's like driving around in a bright red, look at me Ferrari, that's loud. And you wouldn't want that every day. Like there are certain circumstances you don't want to have to deal with that. I think blending in most of the time is certainly what I prefer to do. And you know, pulling up at the, you know, at the service station, they're definitely like the kid working in the servo was very unfriendly and short, and you know, and it's like, yeah, you know, I get it, like I totally get it. But you know, so I think having to tread that balance in those sorts of cars too, I think you do need to, just from a social perspective, be a little bit careful how and when you use them. To not look like a total tosser. But you know, early Sunday morning, 7 a.m. for a belt when the roads are quiet, to go and get a coffee and then put it back in the garage by 10, I think that's the sweet spot of those cars. So
And it is a bit sad that people have that as well, because like you just don't know the circumstances around. I mean, obviously it's not, you know, it's not like it's your car and like
I couldn't even afford to fill the tank of the thing. Like, literally, I couldn't afford to fill the tank.
How big is the tank?
I don't know. It's probably more a reflection of how little money I have rather than how big that tank is. But seriously, like people just don't know that. Like I couldn't afford it. Yeah. I'm thrilled to drive it, you know, but they don't know that. And, you know, and yeah, don't know. But still very cool. Still very, very, very cool. Yeah,
very, very cool. Just the brown interior on those, and
this one's black.
All black?
All black.
Brown. I like the brown of those. Yeah. They're good. Just that period and that thing. You know, and again, same thing. It's one of those, you mentioned like 12-year-old kid dream type thing. Like I think that Brago model of mine is like,
yes,
like the most used model that I've got out of all. Mm-hmm. Like
that and the Brago F40.
Oh yeah. Well, I think I got four of those or something, like four F40s. I liked the F40 a bit when I was a kid. I mean, like just to be able to go drive one and have a little squirt in it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
They're few and far between now, like in terms of seeing them around. They're not dumb a dozen.
No, but you know the really weird thing, and I don't understand this. This is all relatively speaking in Ferrari terms. They're not actually worth that much money. Like you can get a really, in the UK, a really nice Testarossa for kind of £80,000 to £90,000 now. And when you think that 355s are that money, 328s are that money, I mean, obviously if you're talking anything V12, anything 60s and 70s V12 is $300,000-$400,000, they're gone. To think that you can still have a flat 12 Testarossa that looks like that and drives and sounds like that and is that special for like sub £100,000, and this one, I like, don't know what it would be worth, but it's not, you know, it's a lovely car, but it's a bit of a patchy history and it's left hand drive and, you know, a few other things like that. So in terms of bargain Ferraris, they're
it's just amazing, the maintenance that kills those, isn't it? I mean, similar, like why I reckon that's the same reason why 355 prices haven't gone through the roof.
Yeah.
It's just because they're just painfully expensive to maintain. Yeah. And if you are going to try and use the thing, right, you're going to have a lot of money in looking after it.
Well, they cost you money just sitting there, even if you don't use the thing. Mm. Like all the jobs that need to be done by time, irrespective of how far you drive it, like it costs you money just, yeah.
Mm.
But, you know, I don't know, put it into perspective. People are paying, you know, $200,000-$300,000 for like a a 512 BB or something like that. It's like pay a third of the money and then put another 50 grand into as a maintenance budget for 10 years and drive the piss out of the thing. Like, yeah, I don't know.
It's not a bad idea.
We're talking about cars we don't have, so it's all good. But that's the joy of, I think, you know what? I mean, I've been lucky enough to have driven this car, but I think that the great, you know, I think social media has a lot of negatives in our life, but I think one of the true benefits and one of the two great brilliant things about Instagram is you really can kind of enjoy those cars if you're not in a position of owning them. You know, 10-20 years ago they really were off the table, and maybe you'd glimpse one at a car show or maybe you'd see one drive past or something, and that was kind of the only way you got to enjoy those cars. Whereas now there's enough owners that kind of share what they do with their cars and they share the driving, and you know, you follow the right people and you can kind of get a pretty good window into these cars without actually, you know, being in a position to actually own one. And it's not the same, but it's still pretty cool. Well, yeah. I definitely enjoy that. So
cool. Awesome. Well,
Sports Car Safari podcast on a Thursday.
That'd be that.
Yeah. Thank you for joining everybody.
Now are you away next week? You're away next week, aren't you?
I am. I am actually heading down this afternoon to the London Concours and then
did you see the rally stuff that was going on with that? People being good custodians of their cars and still driving.
Well, there's
cars down.
I tell you what, I might go live or do some Insta stories, or maybe I'll just shoot the stills. I'm not sure exactly what I'll do, but there's a little thing.
Option D, all of the above.
All of the above. So basically this,
I'm expecting a FaceTime. I'm expecting
it. Yeah. Hey, we can. It's a bit of a jolly. We're going down to drink some champagne and have some beers. So we're not really going super seriously, but there will be definitely some photos. But there's London Concours is one of the events where at the end of the event, a lot of the entered cars, they all drive there and they drive home. So there's a particular pub that's not too far from the gate of the Concours, and this is in central London. And a good portion of the field all drive out. So the best thing is you get a pint from the pub, you stand on the footpath with your pint, and you just watch Stratos's and O37s. And I mean, last time we were there, and in the course of two or three pints, we saw Mirrors F50s, we saw Stirling Moss's 250 short wheelbase, we saw all of these cars just drive out into the traffic. And you know, the Beast of Turin, the big, you know, 24 litre Fiat aero engine sort of land speed record car that shoots no exhaust system and shoots flames out the side. I saw Duncan Pittaway, who has the car, loading it up onto the trailer. And I sort of went up as a joke and I was like, oh, I thought you'd be driving this home, you know, through traffic, thinking like he wouldn't do that. And then his reaction, he's like, yeah, no, I'm disappointed we can't too. He's like, it's such a shame. He's like, I cracked an oil cooler line getting it onto a ferry in Belgium last week. So, you know, unfortunately, we haven't made the replacement yet. So unfortunately, it's got no oil in it. We can't drive it. So we've got to tow it. But yeah, I'm really bummed too that we can't drive it. And I'm like, what? You were going to drive this aero-engined, flame-spitting 1910s Lance Edwardian land speed record car through central London peak hour traffic on a, like, what? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah. So
that's almost like the greatest thing to do ever, right? To like drive an Edwardian car through the middle of London.
Yes. That'd just be the best. Shoots flames.
But yeah, it was Gerardo and Co.
Gerardo and Co. Yeah.
Gerardo and Co. They had, they drove like what? 037s and Stratos.
Seven and Stratos
stuff there. Down there. That's pretty cool London. Though. Like,
yeah,
that's pretty cool. That should almost be mandatory for attending events like that. Like if you know, almost like with the concourse where you have to like drive the thing up the block to get
them.
If you're not driving it there, you can't traffic.
It's one of those things. It's like, I don't know. I love seeing people, you know, Max Gerardo, and there's a few of these sort of social media friendly classic car guys in the UK and around the world. But I just love the fact that it's like, that's exactly what I would do. You know, like if you've got access to Mickey Biazion's 037, like, and you need to take it to a concourse, like, of course you'd bloody drive it there. Of course you would. And it's good to see someone that has the car actually doing that. And
And I'm not just sitting there not being used. Yeah, 100%. Oh, well, that's cool. So when are you doing that?
Heading down once we wrap up here, a few things to do, and then we're gonna drive down and then next week Boxster around Cornwall. So we might do some Instagram stories yeah, hopefully we don't have anything going wrong, but we might. So we'll see.
I kind of want to just say there's a story, but I also don't want you to be stuck in the middle of nowhere somewhere too. But
come on, mate, you don't care. You really don't care. I do. You'd rather see an interesting story.
No. But no, yes, it would make for an interesting story. It would be good.
Yeah. But either way, it'd be good.
Yeah, it'd be great. So next week you're probably not joining us on podcast then?
Probably not. I'm gonna try and have a bit of a digital detox. We're just saying that the weird thing about coronavirus and the whole working from home thing is that, you know, I haven't, like, you just don't switch off ever, because you're working from home. You're always working from home. And even when it's a Saturday or a Sunday, and I'm not sitting here claiming that I've worked solidly since February, but like, even if it's a Saturday morning and there's just something, you just like, oh crap, I need to send an email, or I need to do this. And you might be there for 15 minutes or something like that, but you just